Hi, I'm Joe Palca on the Science Desk at NPR.
And I'm Christopher Joyce, also on the Science Desk at NPR.
And this is another edition of On Science, the NPR podcast where we tell you all the interesting things that we've been doing and others on the Science Desk have been doing in science this week. So, Chris, this was the week of the big inauguration, and you were at one of the inaugural events that has to do with saving the planet.
That's right, the Green Ball, one of four Green Balls that were held during this week. Lots of swells from the environmental groups as well as people from big companies were there, and we'll listen to what they had to say.
Let's play it.
The first green inaugural ball, well, actually it's one of at least three in Washington this week, is warming up at the National Portrait Gallery. Several hundred environmental movers and shakers are here to celebrate the ascension of an eco-friendly Barack Obama to the presidency. People are munching organic hors d'oeuvres and leaving as small a carbon footprint as the organizers could manage. We're going to go talk to some of them right now.
I found Amy Christensen, who's on the organizing committee for the Green Ball.
Most of us, our day jobs, are spending our time working on the environment. So, of course, we spent a great deal of effort to make sure that what we're doing here has the least footprint, the least impact as possible. Everything from what kind of food we ordered to make sure that we had as many vegetarian and vegan options because of all the energy and water inputs that go into that, to how people could get here to make sure that it was on Metro, very accessible, and that we supported people being able to get here in that way, to the flowers that we're using being reused by people afterward.
Sure, there was carbon in evidence. Big limos, for example, were too deep at the entrance. Christensen acknowledged that being green can become a sort of competitive sport. Someone can always claim to be greener. But for one night, in one place, everyone was singing from the same hymnal, green energy and green jobs, if the new administration can find the money to pay for it. That's something that concerns Roan Resch, president of the Solar Energy Industries Association.
I mean, we're in a recession. There's no doubt about it. And the solar industry is getting as hard, if not harder, than most of the other industries in this country. So what we need in place is an economic recovery bill. And so as we step back and look at the bailout that they did for Wall Street, $800 billion, one would think that there's an opportunity here to put $10 or $20 or $30 billion in the energy industry to help ensure that we create these jobs starting this next month.
If Congress parcels out a big chunk of that stimulus money for environmental projects, some of the companies sponsoring this green ball will take some. Among them are Walmart, the Dow Corning Company, and the American Gas Association, not organizations or companies normally thought of as waving the green flag. And if the recession casts doubt on how a green revolution can be paid for, well, for some businesses, green may seem like the only place where there is money. So argues Amy Argento, who works for Brightworks, a company that helps design green buildings.
Sometimes we'll talk to clients, like, if you don't do this, your option might be to go out of business. I think that this is the way that things are heading, and I think a lot of corporations are jumping on the bandwagon.
How many that bandwagon can hold will depend a lot on how the economy fares under the new administration. At least one speaker at the Green Ball was confident that it would fare well enough.
Tomorrow, a new day begins.
Al Gore, former vice president and climate change guru.
We prove tomorrow at high noon that in the United States of America, political will is indeed a renewable resource.
Once the hangovers have worn off and Barack Obama has moved into the White House, Congress will have to decide how much of the new president's green package the taxpayer can afford.
So, Chris, you know, what I'm wondering from this is there's a certain quality to all this of greenwash. You know, we're all feeling great. You pointed out, well, we all took Metro except for all the limos out front. is this a new version of business as usual, only it's painted green?
Certainly. I mean, it's pretty hard to sort of sort out the, what would they call them, the fly specks from the pepper in this. It is a competitive sport, though. I mean, there's a lot of genuine belief that things are going to be different. And yes, there's lots of people who would say, yes, this is a great movement and I'd like to be part of it because I can make money out of it. But, you know, the direction is different. I mean, it's like moving a big ship. And that certainly has changed direction.
Well, it's pretty clear that something's going to have to happen. But the interesting thing is that the planet is changing, and it may not be that humans can change fast enough, A, to keep up, or B, to do something to stop it. And so one example of that is a piece Richard Harris has about how one part of Antarctica is warming up, but another part is cooling off, and scientists are still trying to figure that out.
Antarctica is so remote, scientists didn't even put permanent weather stations there until 1957, and even those were in just a few scattered places. Eric Steig at the University of Washington says that made it hard to take the continent's temperature.
I like to say it's a little bit like having data in San Francisco and New York and trying to say something about Arizona. You really need some more information if you're going to say anything reasonable about Arizona.
Steig and his colleagues have done just that for Antarctica, taking the sparse temperature records of the past 50 years and combining them with satellite records that cover a much greater area but don't go so far back in time. The result, as they now report in the journal Nature, is that a big chunk of Antarctica, the western part of the continent, has in fact been warming up like the rest of the world, where temperatures have risen by about a degree near the equator to more than 5 degrees near the North Pole.
It's much less than Arctic warming, but it is pretty much on par with global average warming.
Now, Steig says warming isn't necessarily all bad news. Up to a point, Antarctic warming can actually reduce sea level. Warming can take water out of the ocean through evaporation and deposit it on the continent in the form of increased snowfall.
West Antarctica should be getting more precipitation along with this increased temperature. But I think the data to demonstrate that are not really available.
In fact, the best data from Antarctica show that the continent is putting slightly more water into the ocean than it's taking out. Now, the fact that Antarctica is in fact warming up is reassuring in a way to Arctic scientist Richard Alley at Penn State University.
The world looks a little more sensible to me than it did before.
Scientists expect that Antarctica should be heating up according to what they understand about global warming. And the consequence of warming Antarctic air is not cause for panic, Alley says.
For now, most of the Antarctic is still so cold that it's very hard to melt it from above. The big question for Antarctica for the near future is what happens to the ocean, because the warm ocean waters can circulate under the floating extensions of the Antarctic, the ice shelves.
And if warmer water melts those ice shelves, they'll release mountains of ice behind them into the ocean. Scientists have already seen the consequences of that along the relatively warm Antarctic Peninsula. There, at least 8 large ice shelves have melted away in recent decades. David Vaughan from the British Antarctic Survey is on the peninsula right now, keeping a close eye on the Wilkins Ice Sheet, which was once larger than Connecticut but could soon be gone entirely.
We landed on that ice shelf just 2 days ago. Flimsy-looking piece of ice. And that appears to be hanging on by the skin of its teeth.
It could collapse in the next few weeks, he says.
Not all of Wilkins will disappear overnight, but a large part of it could.
That ice sheet is already floating on the ocean, so when it melts, it won't raise sea level. But it's a powerful reminder that change can come quickly and dramatically in this land of ice. Richard Harris, NPR News.
That's one of the things about the Antarctic that has always puzzled me is, vis-a-vis the climate change, is that it's one thing to look at what's happening above the land and air temperature, but what's really the secret to what's going to happen within the Antarctic is what's underneath. In fact, there is an expedition going there this year or next year to do that very thing, which is to send robots down underneath them to look at what's going on underneath those ice sheets.
One of my favorite, I saw a bumper sticker somebody had up in one of the C-130 aircraft that I was on, actually, as we were going down to the Antarctic, that said, ski South Pole, 1 inch of powder and 2 miles of base.
Well, I'm not a skier. I guess that's good.
I guess that's good. Well, so now I think we should switch gears and talk a little bit about an anniversary story. Nell Greenfield Boyce did a story this week about the 50th anniversary of the first report in the literature about these things called pheromones. You know what they are, right, Chris?
I know how to make a pheromone.
Please. Anyway, Nell does this story about the 50th anniversary and whether or not pheromones, which are these chemical signals that are sent between animals, actually exist in humans.
If you go to Google and type in human pheromone, you will get hundreds of thousands of links.
And most of them are trying to sell you something.
Tristram Wyatt studies pheromones at the University of Oxford.
the idea that there is something you can splash on yourself to make you irresistible is the ever-enduring hope.
At least since scientists identified the first known attractant, a chemical sent out by the female silk moth to lure males to her. Its discovery 5 decades ago led scientists to coin that new word, pheromone.
It was built up from two Greek words, a hormone for excite and pheron for transfer. So it was excitement transferred from one individual to another.
Wyatt wrote an essay for this week's issue of the journal Nature that reviews what researchers have learned since the invention of the word. He says there is no doubt that a lot of different animals, including mammals, use chemical signals. But he says no one has identified anything like that for humans, though not for lack of trying. Wyatt says back in the 1980s and 1990s, various chemicals were proposed as being the, quote, human pheromone. A bunch of them belong to a family of steroids related to testosterone.
But there is no good evidence that these actually are the human pheromones. The evidence was always circumstantial and rather poor.
If someone tries to sell you a jar full of something called 100% human pheromones, I guess as a scientist, what's your reaction to that?
Well, I'm afraid it's wasted money.
My name is Bill Horgan. I'm CEO of Human Pheromone Sciences.
Human Pheromone Sciences is based in California. And for $50, it will sell you a blue bottle of what it calls pure human pheromones. Horgan says a key ingredient is one of those chemicals related to testosterone.
Androstenedione is found in the human body. And people who are exposed to it, men and women, indicated a feeling of warmth and lack of negativity, improved positivity.
He says his products affect the person who wears them.
They're not sexual attractants. That's a key thing that we try to get across.
His company's webpage, naturalattraction.com, does say that, quote, human pheromones are gender-specific, naturally occurring substances that trigger specific mating responses. I told Horgan the scientist I'd talked to said no chemical had ever been proven to be a human pheromone. Horgan insisted that studies show his products can produce pheromone-like effects on mood and behavior.
We've seen it and others have seen it, independent of us. In fact, some of them were detractors of us at first. They didn't believe it, like the Monell Institute.
The Monell Chemical Senses Center is a nonprofit institute in Philadelphia and one of the top centers for smell research. Horgan said a researcher at Monell named Charles Wysocki had done a study, and Horgan sent me the report. It said the chemical in his product had produced courtship-like behaviors in women. So I called Wysocki. He said, oh, that study. It was done years ago. He said he had his doubts at the time about the design. The analysis of the results and his collaborators' far-reaching conclusions made him uncomfortable, to the point where he asked to have his name taken off the paper. I sent Horgan an email telling him that. He expressed amazement and said the science behind his company's products is supported by other researchers. Wysocki says, if someone is trying to sell you a bottle of human pheromones,
I'd be very skeptical. Caveat emptor.
Now, Wysocki does believe that body smells can influence other people in various ways. For example, he did one well-controlled study. It did blood tests on women who sniffed samples of male underarm odor.
We did see an alteration in the hormone system that regulates the menstrual cycle.
But he doesn't know what in men's body odor was causing that.
What we are lacking is the actual chemical identities. That's where chemistry has to catch up with the behavior and the endocrinology.
He's trying to find those chemicals, but even if he did identify a human pheromone, Wysocki says whatever effect it had would be subtle. Nothing like the irresistible sex lure that scientists found in moths decades ago. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
One thing that comes to mind when I hear that is that if before you go out and buy what you might think is a pheromone that's going to draw somebody to you, the fact is that a lot of pheromones repel other animals. They found this not with humans, but they found it with fish, for example, have something called threat pheromones, I think they're called. And, you know, if a fish gets bitten, it puts them out and the other fish run away. So be careful when you're dealing with pheromones.
Well, so maybe the next company should be called leavemealone.com.
You wouldn't want to mix it up, you know?
Yeah, right.
Before you go out on a date at the prom.
Jeez, darn. Okay.
We're going to stick with this idea of anniversaries and turn it back to you, Joe, because you were just in England and you were talking to some people about the upcoming anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, who, as most people know, is sort of, well, I guess you call him the top biologist who ever walked the earth.
Well, yeah, certainly probably the most, can I use that horrible word, impactful? Ugh. Anyway.
How about eminent?
Eminent, yes, he's definitely eminent. Actually, as I do these pieces, it turns out that historically speaking, there were quite a few naturalists at the time that Darwin was working that were coming to sort of similar conclusions. And in fact, in his day, Alfred Russel Wallace and Charles Darwin were considered the co-creators of evolution. It's only been in historical retrospect that Darwin has emerged as the guy. But to say that England is agog at the moment about Charles Darwin is not at all an overstatement. And I talked to a guy who has the fantastic title. Can you imagine actually somebody having this title in America? He is the champion of Darwin 200. That's his title. And his name is Bob Bloomfield. And I asked him, we were in the Natural History Museum where he has a day job as the head of public programs. I asked him what kinds of things they were doing for the Darwin 200 celebration.
Well, they range from major efforts by the Wellcome Trust to place experimental education packs for evolution into every school across the United Kingdom, through to tiny groups of knitters creating knitted responses to evolution.
Wait a minute. A knitted response to evolution, how does that work?
Well, for the group are creating artistic knitted elements which are evocative of evolutionary processes. And similarly, there's a very small group also doing quilts, which are doing a Bayeux tapestry of a beagle voyage, in essence.
So that gives you some idea of the flavor of the kind of a lot of serious events, but some pretty wacky.
Well, speaking of, well, I won't call it wacky because I guess it's a legitimate debate. But, you know, it's funny to me, even here in the United States, we look at evolution and places like the Texas State Board of Education is, as we speak, trying to get creationism back into the textbooks. So it's always odd to me the difference between what's going on in Europe and what's going on here.
Right. And I was interested in exploring that a little bit. So I had an interview with Richard Harries, who's the former Bishop of Oxford. And he basically said the problem in the United States is that people in this country seem prone to take the position that the Bible must be word for word literally true.
And that's a total failure to understand that the Bible contains many different forms of literature, and those different forms of literature are expressing truths in different kinds of ways. I mean, do people really think that the universe is only 4,000 years old or whatever, where every science, chemistry, paleontology, physics, astronomy, every single science points with huge amounts of evidence to the Earth being billions of years old and the universe being even more billions of years old. So you just have to ask people, well, what do they make? Do they think that the vast majority of scientists in every scientific discipline on Earth are liars?
So you can see it's from a clergyman, it's not the kind of soundbite that we hear from clergy in this country. They may agree, but it tends to be, at least the ones we hear from, are a little more polarized than that. So it's going to be an interesting series of discussions that I'll be putting on the air in February for the 200th anniversary.
Okay, it sounds like a fun and interesting series of stories. Thanks for joining us. This has been On Science. Next week, we'll be doing the same thing, so come and listen. Thanks, Joe.
You bet. See you, Chris.
Bye.